Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, and Susanna Caldwell of the Alaska Dispatch Anchorage Daily News. Paul, in 1952, an Air Force C-124 Globemaster crashed near the Colony Glacier here in south central Alaska. 52 men perished. Now, finally, some of the remains of those men have been recovered. This has been a story for more than 60 years.
It's incredible, isn't it? It was on November 22nd, 1952. It went down above Colony Glacier on Mount Gannett, and 52 people aboard. It wasn't until 2012, it was on a flight from Washington to Elmendorf. It went down, it was found 6 days later, but covered by snow and then kind of enveloped by the glacier and it went away. It showed up again in 2012 when there was a training exercise up there. And has found bits and pieces and flotsam and jetsam from the aircraft little mementos and things from the aircraft and the bodies. And they've managed to identify through the center in Hawaii, the POW MIA Center, Identification Center, 17 of the bodies now. And they're working to identify the rest. And it's got to be something for these families after all these years to finally know for sure what happened to their uncles.
And Paul, the Globemaster would have been a big aircraft.
That's
for
a big
time.
Aircraft too. The C-124, it's a cargo aircraft. Military always uses them to transport personnel.
So. And isn't this the same aircraft that there were rumors for years that there was gold bullion on board or some shipment of
that.
Wealth?
Yeah, you've heard that. I'd heard that about several aircraft up here. And wasted a lot of time looking and never found it, so.
Okay. Susanna, you've been tracking the Kuskokwim fishery. Once again, there's a salmon shortage, and once again, locals are unhappy with the managers.
That's correct, yeah. There are a lot of comparisons being made to 2012 when there was protest fishing on the river, when villagers defied management orders to not catch king salmon. This year, there have been really harsh restrictions on the river in place since the beginning of the season, which started in May. And that's led to some anxiety because people who live in villages along the Kuskokwim River out in western Alaska, they're very dependent on these fish for food. And they say that with these harsh restrictions in place, that they're not able to target the salmon that they need. Right now, there's a lot of really interesting changes that are happening on the river. For example, the river is being managed by federal managers this year instead of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the State Department, which has always...
How did that happen? The state usually resists that tooth and nail.
Right. Well, a village along the river asked the Federal Subsistence Board to have federal managers of the river this year. And it's worth noting that the federal fishery only applies to the Chinook salmon run, not the sockeye or the chum. So the state still has authority over the other species of salmon. The feds just have authority over king salmon. This is all related to a crashing king fishery out there. Last year was the lowest run on record in the region, 94,000 king salmon returned. Usually there's an average of about 260,000 fish come back
each year. This is only on the Kuskokwim.
This is only on the Kuskokwim. And of course, all across Alaska, there have been restrictions placed on rivers in an attempt for king salmon management conservation. So it looks like fishermen are actually going to have a chance to fish starting today at around 4 o'clock down on the lower river. It's easing some of the anxiety. Still, managers are being very cautious. The power of that fishery is very, very intense. There are a lot of fishermen who fish very hard to get this food. And so they're worried that if there are too many openings and they catch too many king salmon, then all of this conservation that they've had in place for so long is all for naught.
And typically, how long does the fishery last? How long can they catch fish on the Kuskokwim?
Well, right now we're on the back end of the king run. Through a good part of the summer, like into July, there will still be fishing for sockeye and chum salmon.
Okay, thank you. Tim, the Vote Yes campaign, the supporters of the oil tax repeal referendum that will appear on the August primary ballot, finally made the front page of the paper. They make the front page by apologizing to former Democratic Governor Tony Knowles. What happened?
Michael, this seems to be a case of a, and it happens in political campaigns, particularly heated campaigns, which this one is turning out to be. Enthusiastic campaign volunteers, in this case, somebody, things got carried away. Somebody called Governor Knowles a shill for the oil industry, which when you say something like that to about a former governor, you better have your ducks lined up. And in this case, he or she didn't.
Well, that's the kind of thing you hear in letters to the editor and rhetoric on the street. You usually don't get it out of the campaign.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, campaign volunteers, sometimes young people who are not experienced and not maybe new to the state. And don't understand that even in the heat of a campaign, people you disagree with, you treat people with respect, and particularly former governors. However, Vic Fisher and Jack Roderick, two of the spearheads of the Vote Yes campaign, did the right thing. They apologized, and that's good. It was very courteous of them, and I think Governor Knowles accepted that.
Okay. And oil and gas expert Mark Myers takes issue with Scott Goldsmith, who is the economist who's come forward on behalf of the Vote No group to vote against the repeal, to say, no, this is going to be really bad for Alaska. And Myers says, well, I think he basically says Goldsmith's approach can't be trusted. He hasn't proven anything.
Well, I have been looking closely at that the last couple of days, Michael, and I think Mark is wrong on a couple things. His principal objection seems to be that Scott's analysis, ISCR, was not peer-reviewed. And I asked Gunnar Knapp, the director of ISCR, about that. And Gunnar said that there are many different standards of peer review in various scientific agencies, which is the world Mark Myers comes out of. There's a very rigorous peer review, scientific peer review process. Biologists do this typically. Typically, it takes a year to get it peer reviewed before a paper can be published in an academic journal. A lot of materials that the ISCR puts out are more for public education, and they are not given the same standard of peer review. They're put around people, other researchers in the institute read them. It goes out to the public.
I can't, I don't know what Scott Goldsmith's intent was, but this became a political document, and the people who were applauding it, Tony Knowles among them, they clearly want this to be a political document.
Well, but it really was, really what Scott's analysis did is it compared the tax, the old tax with the new tax. And frankly, he came to the same conclusion the Department of Revenue had. I mean, I listened to Commissioner Rodell tell legislators back in January, and gave the same analysis. And what Scott did is he did an independent verification of what the Department of Revenue had already found out, which is basically that the new tax doesn't raise any more, any less revenue. The two are about the same in the revenue impact. There are other problems with the new tax, other problems with the old tax, but in terms of the revenue impact, they're about the same. And that's his principal conclusion. And people have quibbled about some of his methodology, but nobody has argued with him on that central
point.
And
I suppose in 5 years we'll all be a lot smarter, because then we'll have 5 years of information, right?
Right. And after August, we'll all be a lot smarter about things, too, particularly about how this is going to come out.
Okay, Paul, anything you want to add here?
I looked at this, and I just wonder, Mr. Myers is a geologist, not an economist. I kind of wonder, and he was on the AGEA team, I guess, for Palin, kind of put us in this pot to start with, I think, with AGEA. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of agree with him. It's you look at the methodology and you look where we wound up. I don't see it.
Actually, I think Mark left the state. He wasn't actually on the AGEA team, but the people that were around him were, right, like Marty,
exactly,
Rutherford,
right,
Deputy Commissioner, were architects, right, of the AGEA. But Mark, I think, had left by that time and gone to the USGS, then came back to the university. Right. What kind of saddened me about this whole thing is just the idea of, one branch, one. Mark is the Deputy Assistant Provost for Research at UAF. Mm. Pretty senior position, yep, and to have one part of the university throwing rocks at another part of the university is sort of sad, I think.
Yep.
Okay, but isn't that what academics do all the time? They have disputes. It's a hardy perennial of universities.
Professors might, but vice chancellors and
That's probably true too.
Know.
Okay, Susanna, and yes, there's more news about another ballot proposition: the legalization of marijuana. What are the developments this week?
Well, so a few weeks ago, the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol in Alaska, which is the campaign that's working to legalize marijuana, received $140,000 from the Marijuana Policy Project. That's a national organization that has been working across the country to either change or legalize marijuana laws all over. That raises the campaign total for them to about $500,000 total, which has mostly come from the Marijuana Policy Project. So things are sort of heating up, I guess you could say. Things are getting a bit larger. They're sort of dominating in comparison to the anti-legalization campaign, Big Marijuana, Big Mistake, Vote No on Two. They've only received about $30,000, mostly in much smaller donations, though one large donation from a native corporation. So anyway, the debate's sort of heating up. One thing that came out this week was the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police released the results of a survey that they did where they polled 37 different chiefs of police or high administrators in local police departments in Alaska to ask them what the impacts of marijuana legalization could be on their departments. They overwhelmingly said that there will be increased costs on their departments if marijuana is legalized, to the tune of about what they estimate is $6 million. So
that's for the whole state or for these particular combined police chiefs?
That's just for the local police departments. And it's worth noting that the survey only contacted local police departments. It didn't contact state troopers or any federal law enforcement agencies to get their take on how much it might cost. The state has already done its own estimate on how much it might cost the Department of Public Safety. It's about $2.4 million, I believe, over 2 years if marijuana is legalized.
So these police chiefs are able to speculate on or have some informed opinion about how many people they expect to arrest for various offenses?
Well, actually, the cost, the way that they calculated what they think the cost will be, comes down to training. How much it's going to cost to train officers to potentially deal with more people who are impaired under the influence of marijuana while they're driving. That's a big thing. A lot of officers do have some sort of drug recognition training, but the chiefs of police are saying we need more. We need a more intense kind of training. Some of them also said that they would need more school resource officers because they anticipate an increase in teen marijuana use if marijuana is legalized.
And the money that came from the Marijuana Policy Project, if the local campaign talked about how they're going to spend it, but
you know, they didn't go into specifics. Obviously, they're playing their cards sort of close to their chest. They did criticize this report, though. They said that there's really no science, no studies that show that if marijuana is legalized, that there will necessarily be more impaired drivers. They say there are already impaired drivers out on the street. Maybe you should focus on that instead of sort of criticizing potential legalization and potential increase in use.
And if you read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the major newspapers, they've all done some kind of reporting on what's gone on in Colorado and Washington. And it seemed to me, my impression was the evidence is highly anecdotal and that it's not really beyond that.
Right, which is interesting because the Anchorage Chief of Police, Mark Mew, he had a statement yesterday. He spoke with reporters. He is against this. And he basically said, you know, we need to wait and see what Colorado does, among other things. He also has really big challenges with what the federal law will mean to officers here in Anchorage and how, you know, they take a sworn oath when they become an officer to uphold local, state, and federal laws. And if marijuana is legalized here but still illegal at the federal level, how are they going to keep their oath is sort of his big question. He thinks it's a bit of a slippery slope and people should be more cautious.
Thank you. Tim, the oil industry has long been interested in the Umiat prospect. Mm-hmm. Now Link Energy is test drilling. What are they finding at Umiat? We better start out with where is it for those who haven't been around here?
Umiat is a long way away. And I'm probably one of the few people who's been to Umiat, both in summer and winter. But it is way out in the middle of nowhere. It's on the upper Colville River, right, 100 miles west of the Dalton Highway and the pipeline. It's right within the National Petroleum Reserve. It's right on the river, as a matter of fact. The Navy back in the late 1940s drilled early and found oil there. It was not a very big oil deposit, but it was literally very shallow, literally in the permafrost, very light. You could so light you could actually run it through diesel engines without refining.
Is this the kind of place where there were leaks on the ground?
There are seeps there, which is one of the things I noticed. I was involved in helping research some seeps there, but it's not oil oozing out of the ground, not in big quantities. But Link Energy is a small entrepreneurial independent company that decided to take a fly at this to see. These reserves are small, but they've long been known. And Link got some leases there, gambled that there would be more oil maybe down below, which they drilled last year, and they unfortunately found that there wasn't. So this year, this past winter, they tried to experiment to see if they can get the oil to flow out of the permafrost. And they did get some to flow, but not as much as they had hoped. So they've got to go back now, do more work. Small company, they're going to have to bring in a partner, they say, to see if they can make it work. But it's technically a very challenging, very interesting project.
And if they were able to find what they thought was production level amount per day or per month or however they want to measure it, how would they transport it? How would they get it to refineries and markets? Would they have their own refinery?
No, Michael, what they would do is they would have a small pipeline to the TAPS pipeline, which is 100 miles to the east. Either that or they could build north about the same distance and transport it through the existing network around the Kuparuk and the Prudhoe Bay fields. But but they're hoping to get eventually 50,000 barrels a day out of the field. Now, whether they can do that or not, I mean, there's a lot of technology problems. It's cold oil. It's frozen in the permafrost. Not quite frozen because oil doesn't freeze at the same temperature that water does, but the stuff is locked in the permafrost, so how do you get it out of there? So it's interesting.
And they would want to know, I assume, 50,000 barrels a day for how many years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I think long-term they're hoping they'll find more resources there than the Navy found. But it's interesting, this thing has been known for decades, and nobody's ever figured out a way to do something with it. So give these guys credit. They're
trying. In some ways, that's the story of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, right? People knew the oil was there, but the question in the 50s and early 60s was, how do you get it anyplace? You can do anything with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul, drum roll, the U.S. Senate race continues. What is the latest?
It's all love and roses. These guys love each other. They're being respectful. It's not a problem. We should move on. This is the oddest. This is, to me, just standing back watching this, the strangest race. There's not really a Republican primary. There's Dan Sullivan fighting with Mark Begich. Mead Treadwell, another GOP primary person, has done very little to nothing, spent nothing, and only has about two more weeks to decide to do something. Joe Miller is in there mucking around. He's good for 10, 12 points probably at the end of this. But mostly the Democrats and Mark Begich and the outside group supporting him and Dan Sullivan and the outside group supporting him, they're duking it out over money. Who's got the most? Where's it coming from? You're a dirty dog because
you've got more than me. Well, it seems to me that this is, with Sullivan, by design, it makes him the presumptive nominee.
Well, they've decided he's the nominee, it looks like, from the outside anyway. The biggest people want to cripple him long before he gets to the general election. I guess it must be like a Democratic strategist nightmare to think to yourself, well, the day after the primary, Sullivan's lost and Mead Treadwell's the guy. We've just spent $20 million beating up the wrong guy. Now what do we do?
So another $20 million beating up the right guy.
There we go. So basically, they've spent $20 million, plan to spend $20 million. It's going to be way more than that. There's only 489,294 registered voters in the state as of a couple of weeks ago. Comes down to $40.87 a piece. Maybe they just pay them off and be done with it and save some money in the long run.
Tim, this is a remarkable election in one sense to me, and that is, of course, you've got television. There's very little newspaper advertising, but there's all kind of web advertising. If you want to listen to the Beach Boys on my computer, the first thing you're going to see is Dan Sullivan.
I've seen actually very little. I guess I'm kind of old-fashioned. I pay a lot of attention to print. I'm surprised by how little print evidence of Dan Sullivan meeting the U.S. Senate Dan Sullivan I've seen. There must be a lot of other stuff going on. But
my guess would see if you support this guess that this is outside consultants who tell them television or social media is where it's at. Print's old.
Yeah, I don't know. Also signs. I mean, I see a lot of Dan Sullivan for Lieutenant Governor signs, and of course Bill Walker's famous. That's the way he runs his campaign. Mm-hmm. and pretty effectively, by the way. That's his strategy. But I've seen very few. I was in Kenai last weekend. I did see two Dan Sullivan for Senate signs. A lot of Joe Miller signs down there in Kenai.
And in the valley, too.
Yeah. By the way, the vote no, vote yes, it's like flowers coming up.
And they are everywhere. Right?
There's a stretch on I Street where there's vote no, vote nest, neighbors next to each other, you know, and I've got to go
the
get
one
a picture
I've,
of this.
I've seen is, I'm going to paraphrase this, they are pasted on light poles.
Oh, I've
and I'm
seen
certain
some
this
of those.
Is almost, that's illegal, I believe.
Yeah, it is.
And they're just black on paper of this size, 11 by 8 size, saying vote no on BS 21.
Clearly grassroots.
No, that's about as grassroots as you can get, I guess. Paul, anything else on the Senate race?
No, it's going to be more interesting as it goes on.
Okay. Tim, everyone's aware, all of our listeners and panelists, about the strife in Iraq. It continues day after day. Could the warfare in Iraq, the social unrest, influence the price of oil and particularly Alaska North Slope crude?
Michael, I'm told that it already is influencing the price of oil. It tends to obviously influence if oil supplies from exports from Iraq are cut off. It hits the price of those particular qualities of oil go up. Whether it affects our prices, our gas pump prices, our revenues remains to be seen. There hasn't quite been a large effect. I tend to believe, based on past experiences, that these things are psychological. I mean, it's not a supply issue because there's lots and lots of oil. I mean, God, North Dakota is putting out 1 million barrels a day now, announced last week. Lots of oil in the market. So the fact that there's a convulsion in the Middle East cut off might, you know, psychologically drive up and spike the price of oil, but it'd be just for a short-term reaction.
The other thing I noticed is that there's a gas station near my house where oil or gasoline for your automobile is now $3.99 a gallon. And you start thinking, does that have something to do with Iraq? But then you remember, well, it was this way a couple years ago in the winter when nobody was talking about Iraq.
Also, these things move for reasons, you know, that are hard to explain. A lot of it's seasonal. You know, the gasoline demand's up in the summer, so the price bumps up a little bit. Maybe your gas station operator raises the price and blames Iraq, too.
Suzanne, remember that in April, the mining giant at Rio Tinto gave nonprofits its stock in the Pebble Partnership. Now some of those nonprofits are selling their stock or preparing to. And remind us, who are some of these nonprofits?
So, yeah, it's worth noting that these two nonprofits who received the stocks in April, the Alaska Community Foundation and the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Education Foundation, which it's worth noting, that's a nonprofit that's legally separate from the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. However, the Native Corporation is a major funder, and the Education Foundation, its sole purpose is to provide scholarships and educational opportunities for shareholders of the corporation. They received these stocks in April, 18 million stocks. At the time, they were valued at
shares,
and they were valued at about $16 million. Last week, they sold all of those shares to the tune of about $6.48 million for each organization. They said that they sold them because having these shares was just not in line with their core missions, which both of these organizations are going to use the money to provide scholarships for. For the Education Foundation, it's for shareholders of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and for the Alaska Community Foundation, it's broader, it's statewide. It's interesting. It was a surprise in April when Rio Tinto gifted these stocks, these shares, because it didn't really line up that particularly the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Education Foundation would receive these, because the corporation has been very critical of the project. Yeah, it represented about 19.1% of the Pebble Partnership. So if these organizations had decided to hang on to the shares, they could have potentially had some sort of say in where the very controversial project is going.
Who were the buyers?
Oh, I'm not. It's just like out into the market. Yeah,
oh, it's into
just
the market.
Liquidated.
So it isn't. Yeah. Isn't okay. It isn't
yeah.
like there's one buyer.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. And it's interesting. I contacted the Pebble Partnership, and they were happy that the shares were sold, and they show that there remains interest in the project. However, they are still looking for a partner. They lost Rio Tinto. They've also lost Anglo American in September of last year. So they're trying to get into the permitting stage of the mine process, and they're still optimistic that they can do it.
Okay, on that note, we got to get Paul Jenkins there for the last word. Paul, our colleague Dermot Cole reminds us, the future of Fort Greely may depend on an upcoming missile test or series of tests. Military has spent a great deal of money at Greely on interceptor missiles. What's going on?
There are 14 of those interceptor missiles, I guess, stationed at Fort Greely. It's a $40 billion project. The idea is to hit incoming missiles with a thing that's not much bigger than a shoebox. And this is a missile traveling at thousands of miles an hour. The test will be firing, I guess, from somewhere in the Marshall Islands. 6 minutes later, they'll fire from Vandenberg in California and try to hit this missile to see if this kill package can actually do the job. If it's successful, the program proceeds. If it's a minor glitch, they'll fix it and try it again. And if it's a major glitch, I don't think anybody really knows what they're going to do at this point.
Although we do know how hard it is for the government to kill programs.
It's the hardest thing in the world to do is kill a government program. That's right.
Okay, on that note, we have to say goodbye. I will not be here next week, the 27th. I will be in Fairbanks. My colleague Lori Townsend will be here with other guests for Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.